It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Well, we got a lot to cover, and one of the things I wanted to mention right off the bat, so that give people time to get out there and help out. The Pakistan earthquake, of course, is the numbers keep rolling up in terms of the death toll. I think the last I read was 79,000 confirmed, and there is a flight leaving today from Seattle of support, different items,
supplies.
Yeah. And literally as soon as the show's done, we'll be driving over to give a bunch of coats and blankets that I have dug up. But the things that they're looking for are tents, blankets, sleeping bags, sweaters, socks, but they have to be new, gloves, or heavy coats. And they're collecting that from 9 to 11 this morning at several different locations. The Islamic School of Seattle is one of those locations, which is at 720 25th Avenue. There's also locations in Shoreline and Tacoma. The Shoreline location is at Shurgard Storage, which is 241 Ballinger Way Northeast. And the Tacoma location is the Islamic Center in Tacoma at 2010 Bridgeport Way West. And that's in University Place.
Yeah, the government of Pakistan has had a really slow and inadequate response to the earthquake, so it's really important that the private donations
and only
be said to help out.
Yeah, and only now is the UN finally kind of getting on board and sending aid to Pakistan.
Yeah, nearly a week later.
Yeah.
So again, you can take your donations from 9 to 11 this morning to, again, the Islamic School of Seattle at 720 25th Avenue here in Seattle. All right, moving along. Let's stick with international. It looks like Australian TV had some footage this week of U.S. soldiers, but probably not what they had, what the U.S. Military had planned to get out.
No, in fact, a U.S. soldier or Australian TV reporter was embedded with U.S. troops in Afghanistan, caught on videotape some footage of U.S. soldiers burning the dead bodies of Taliban, killed Taliban fighters, and then using the burning of the bodies, which is considered a desecration in the Muslim faith to burn a dead body, use that as psychological warfare. That aired on Australian TV, and the U.S. has been trying to deal with the damage ever since.
Yeah, it's kind of reminiscent of the incident in Fallujah, where the four dead U.S. contractors had their bodies burned, and for that reason we destroyed the town of Fallujah and many of its inhabitants. But this has gotten very little airplay in the United States. The Pentagon is trying to deal with the fallout. They've promised an investigation. Who knows whether that will lead anywhere? But once again, it's riled up a lot of anti-U.S. sentiments in Afghanistan.
And just like Abu Ghraib, it's being billed as an aberration, something that is not U.S. policy. However, the Australian reporter, when he's been interviewed by the U.S. press and by reporters around the world, has in particular said that right after the burning of the bodies, a U.S. psychological team then took that information and broadcast it to a nearby village and told them, basically, this is what we do. You guys are cowards. We're going to kill you, and then we're going to burn your bodies, blah, 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 which makes it sound a lot like it is U.S. policy to do these kinds of things. And it is, in fact, a violation of the Geneva Conventions, which requires troops in wartime to show respect for the enemy dead.
All right, moving over to Syria, there was a UN report that came out this week.
Yeah, a report by a German prosecutor that said that the assassination earlier this year of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri was the work of the Syrian intelligence. In fact, it was traced directly to the brother and brother-in-law of Assad, the ruler of Syria. Condi Rice and George Bush and John Bolton at the United Nations are using this to wag their fingers at Syria, threaten sanctions or further action. We're going to be hearing a lot more about this because the United States wants to take it and run with this particular incident. So it's a little bit frightening, but it does underscore the fact that that Syria sponsors international terrorism. This is something we've known for many years. The question is what to do about it, and the United States, of course, is taking the most aggressive possible response. But we're going to, and Britain is right with them on this. Jack Straw, the foreign minister of Britain, has weighed in, saying that this simply can't be left sitting on the table. So we're, as I said, we're going to hear more about this unfortunate incident.
But I find it interesting that the U.S. response, rather than supporting the democracy movement in Lebanon, they're seeing this as an opportunity to attack Syria in the UN and impose sanctions, and I'm guessing also to eventually use the military option, as the Bush administration puts it.
All right. Well, that moves us over to... Whoops. That was not what we wanted.
Let's have some nice cheery music for Iraq.
Jim Hightower. How about we move over to This Week in Iraq without the music intro?
Okay, that's
Iraq,
fine.
Iraq.
On Sunday, the U.S. press reported that Iraq's constitutional referendum had been approved by Iraqi voters. Actually, they were a little bit quick on the draw. In fact, it's still far too soon to say. Now, for the Constitution to have been defeated, it would have had to have been rejected by a two-thirds majority in three provinces in Iraq. Well, initial results showed that two provinces did reject it by a very high margin, something like 97% in Anbar province and something like 80% in Salahuddin province, which means a third province would need to reject it by a two-thirds majority to defeat the referendum. Well, initial results from two of the key provinces, Diyala and Nineveh, were very suspicious, and they were very incomplete as of Sunday when the results were announced. There is a Sunni majority in both provinces, but the initial returns from Diyala said there was a 70% yes vote versus a 20% no vote. And the initial results from Nineveh showed a 78% yes vote versus a 21% no vote. Now, the suspicious thing was in the turnout figures. In Nineveh, no turnout percentage was given at all, which was strange, given that there was a turnout percentage given for every other province. The other turnout percentages in Shiite provinces were suspiciously high in a couple of them, including the province of Babel, which showed a 100% turnout, which is unheard of in any election I have ever seen before. In the province of Tamim, where the capital city is Kirkuk, the city that is of mixed ethnicity with a Sunni population, some Shiites living there, a lot of minority groups, and a large Kurdish population as well. The turnout in Tamim province was billed at 78%, which was very, very high, and leads to the suspicion that there might have been some ballot box stuffing going on there. In the Shiite provinces in the south, the average turnout was somewhere between 50 and 60%, which is more to be expected. Now, excuse me, almost immediately on Sunday and Monday, the Iraqi Electoral Commission said that it would recount the ballots from provinces with suspicious numbers, but it wouldn't say which of those provinces it was going to do a recount on. However, British reporters were able to get an IEC member to say that they were counting the ballots from Mosul, from the city of Mosul, which is in Nineveh province, and that was highly classified, and they were trying to be very, very careful in the count of ballots from Mosul. Now, vote monitors during
careful the, in what sense?
Well, they wouldn't say. He wouldn't elaborate. Vote monitors around the country were drawn mostly from Iraqi political parties, which is a clear conflict of interest in this case. There were almost no international monitors at all, other than a few reporters scattered here and there. Most of the reporters, of course, were Iraqis working as stringers for Western press agencies. UN monitors, in fact, remained in Amman, Jordan, because they would be safe from attack there. They figured that they would be attacked if they were at polls on election day in Iraq. However, no attacks were recorded on Election Day. No sizable attacks at all, except for U.S. troops attacking rebels in the city of Ramadi, the capital city of Anbar, where, in fact, only 2,000 people were able to make it to the polls on Saturday. In fact, in the province of Anbar, more than 60 polling places didn't even open, and yet the Sunnis turned out in massive numbers. There was something like a 70 to 80% turnout in the city of Fallujah. It might even have been higher than that. Now, Sunni poll observers in the province of Diyala, one of the two contested provinces, said that Iraqi soldiers confiscated ballot boxes in the province and that there were more votes cast there than there were registered voters. The initial IEC reported turnout in Diyala was 57%, but in Salahuddin province, which did vastly reject the constitution, there was an 88% turnout of mostly Sunnis. And Fallujah had, as I said before, somewhere around 80% turnout. So it seems kind of suspicious that Diyala only had 57% when it has a Sunni majority and it has a very active Kurdish and Shiite groups trying to pass the constitution. You would expect a much higher turnout rate in that province. Now, what that says, combined with no turnout figures for Nineveh province, what that says to me and says to some other critics who were watching the elections, is that the only returns that were reported on Sunday were those from Shiite and Kurdish regions in Diyala and Nineveh, and that's where they got the high yes vote count, and that the Sunni regions had not reported in or had not been allowed to report in yet. And so there's some speculation that much of the counting that's taking place right now is in those two provinces. Now, another thing that points to that is that in Nineveh in January, Kurds and Shiites had amassed something like 130,000 votes total for their candidates. But now, somehow, they've come up with 350,000 yes votes for the constitution, more than double the votes that were cast in January, which is highly suspicious. It might mean some votes were altered, ballot boxes were stuffed, etc.
See, democracy is on the march.
Yeah.
Which direction, we won't say, but...
Yeah, and we won't really know the totals, at least the totals from the recount, until at least next week, and maybe not even then, because in January it took them about 3 weeks to count all the votes. So it could be a little while before we know what the outcome of Saturday's election is. And it is far from sure that the Constitution has passed. Excuse me. The other bit of news from Iraq this week is the beginning of Saddam's trial. It started this week. He's being tried not on the gassing of Kurds in Halabja, but he's being tried on an assassination attempt that was made against him in Dujail, and then the repercussions that came from that, including the execution of 143 people in Dujail, the razing of a whole section of the town, burning of houses, the displacement of families, etc. It's a very narrow crime, considering what he's actually done during his term as president of Iraq, but it's one that the prosecutors think will stick. Now, what's very interesting about the trial of Saddam is that it was reported in the Western media that his trial was continued so that the defense would have more time to prepare. It was delayed so that the defense would have more time to prepare, and it'll reconvene November, I think, 28th was the date.
Yeah.
And that's not at all the view that you can get if you read the British press. Patrick Coburn, for example, from The Independent, said that the trial was continued because none of the witnesses showed up to testify, that in fact the climate of fear is so bad right now surrounding the trial and in the city of Baghdad, even though it's being held in the green zone in a highly guarded facility, that they were having trouble finding judges to sit on the panel that would judge him. That in fact the two of the judges, only one judge's name has been released. That's the Chief Justice. He's a Kurdish judge who, in fact, Saddam Hussein, when he came into court, took one look at the judge and said, "Who the heck are you?" he'd never seen the guy before, and this is the president of Iraq, who would be expected to know who all the major judges are. And that's one of the reasons why they're having a hard time finding judges to sit on the panel. Nobody wants to actually do it and suffer attacks or repercussions from that. the four other judges on the panel are hooded. Their names have not been released, and it appears that two of them have never, ever sat as a judge before. So there's some question about the legitimacy of the trial in that respect. Also, the UN refuses to support the trial because the Iraqi government has insisted that they want to have the death penalty as an option, which the UN does not support. Also, there are some questions about the lower burden of proof. In fact, the prosecution does not need to prove that Saddam is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. They just need to be able to prove it to the satisfaction of the five judges, which is a much lower burden than he would get in Western courts. And also, there's no jury. So there are some questions about not just you know, the qualifications of the judges in this case, but also whether or not this is going to really be a legitimate trial. And as Patrick Coburn said, you know, if they can't get the witnesses to come and testify, well, it could just end up being a show trial that has no value at all.
Yeah, there was also an incident a couple days ago where one of the members of the defense team who was shown on Iraqi TV was promptly assassinated. So
that's right.
There's very much a climate of fear surrounding the trial.
Yeah. So that wraps up This Week in Iraq.
All right. Well, sticking with international, one more minute. Karen Hughes, she was talking about Iraq this week.
Oh, yeah. The Bush
and the crimes of Saddam Hussein.
And tell us who she is.
The Bush administration knows that the Muslim world isn't too happy with us, so they got this great idea to get somebody to go around the world and serve as our ambassador, our diplomat, our sort of marketing...
Goodwill ambassador.
Our marketing manager. To polish up the U.S.'s image in the Muslim world. And they chose Karen Hughes, the woman who was Bush's marketing manager during his run for governor of Texas in his first presidential election. Karen Hughes has been going around to Muslim countries, meeting with women's groups, intellectual students, et cetera, answering questions, trying to polish up the U.S.'s image and explain why we invaded Iraq. Now, this week, she got caught talking to a group of women in Jakarta, saying that she thought Saddam Hussein was guilty of gassing hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. The actual quote is, "He had murdered hundreds of thousands of his own people using poison gas." Well, the actual figure is somewhere around 5,000 people who were killed in the village of Halabja in the Kurdish north of the country. And it's far from clear whether it was only the Iraqi troops who had gassed them. There's some evidence that Iran may also have gassed the village of Halabja and contributed to the death of those 5,000 people. But Karen Hughes compounded her mistake when she was challenged on that by someone in the audience. She actually said, when asked to elaborate on that, she actually said, quote, "I know it was upwards of 200,000. I think it was almost 300,000. That is my recollection. They were put in mass graves." Now, that sounds exactly like something George Bush would say, making up the numbers to support your case.
And 100,000 here or there. I mean, what's the difference?
No, I think she got the number hundreds of thousands stuck in her head because she's probably been asked over and over again on her tour why the U.S. supported sanctions against Iraq that killed hundreds of thousands of people.
All right. Valerie Plame, what is going on with that case?
Well, it might be an exciting week coming up in the Valerie Plame case. Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, is getting ready to announce whether he will hand down indictments in the case. And the speculation is that if indictments do come, that they will be much broader than simply the issue of whether Plame's identity was released by the Bush administration in violation of the law, but there's also a question of cover up and whether Scooter Libby, the chief of staff for Vice President Dick Cheney, and Karl Rove, in particular the chief political advisor for President Bush, whether they've been telling consistent and truthful stories to federal prosecutors or not. There's also some question of whether the indictments might go further than that. So We're going to wait and see. Fitzgerald has a reputation for being fairly strict and fairly apolitical, that you cannot make stick, as is happening in the Tom DeLay case, where DeLay is saying that the prosecutor in the case is a Democrat and is a liberal and it's a political witch hunt and yada, yada, yada. That's not going to be able to happen with that Patrick Fitzgerald. It'll be very interesting to see what the response is and whether these administration figures will be held accountable if, in fact, they are indicted.
Yeah, right now it's clear that Libby is in trouble. He has discussed the Valerie Plame identity with reporters. He's also been caught in a lie, saying that he got the information from Tim Russert of NBC, when, in fact, Tim Russert got the name from him. Definitely Scooter Libby is going to be in trouble. Carl Rove, also Libby testified that Rove had discussed their press contacts, what press contacts they each had before the leak of the identity of Valerie Plame. And Rove is probably going to be pulled into this. The question right now, they're looking at whether or not Dick Cheney had a hand in this, because they want to know where Scooter Libby and Carl Rove got the information of who Valerie Plame was. At the time, if you recall, Dick Cheney was actually at the CIA quite a lot, trying to massage some of the information on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. And it's very possible that he got the information there and passed it on to Scooter Libby, and then Rove and Libby decided what to do with it. Or it's possible he passed on the information and told them what to do with it.
Yeah. The other interesting thing that's come out is that apparently the efforts by Libby and Rove to massage reporters and to leak the name of Valerie Plame started long before Joseph Wilson made public his criticisms of the Bush administration for twisting the facts to suit their WMD claims. The previous theory had been that when Wilson went public with an op-ed piece in the New York Times, that's when the smear campaign started. But apparently, there was a meeting between Libby and some reporters that happened several weeks prior to that. The administration was already trying to get at Wilson because they knew he had this information, and they knew that he was critical of the Bush administration and where it was going.
Which smacks of the kind of techniques Karl Rove was famous for in Texas when he was a bigwig in Texas politics.
Yep.
Well, you speaking of Texas, you had mentioned Tom DeLay. Anything else significant in that case this week?
Yeah, Tom DeLay was indicted and went before a judge this week. What I found kind of interesting reading about DeLay's case, I mean, he came up before the judge, and his lawyer, the first thing he said was, I want the judge to recuse himself because he's a Democrat. He contributed to John Kerry's campaign and to MoveOn.org, which I thought was kind of interesting, because the very first thing that Saddam Hussein did when he stepped into the criminal court last week was he looked at the judge and he said, "Who the heck are you?" It's there's kind of an interesting parallel going on there that I'm sure nobody else really has seen.
Powerful figures and the judges they've bought.
Yeah, or the judges they can't buy.
Yeah.
All right. So. Well, speaking of judges, Harriet Myers doesn't appear to be doing so well with becoming a judge.
Yeah. it was released this week that she'd filled out a questionnaire by Texans United for Life when she was running for office, in which she said that she would support a shift in the Supreme Court away from abortion rights, particularly banning abortion except for when it endangers the life of the mother, which I think is a pretty clear statement of where she stands on abortion.
Yeah, I think we knew this already, because we knew how like-minded Harriet Myers and George Bush were. If you want a sense of how Myers is going to vote on the Supreme Court, ask yourself how Bush would vote, because Bush is notorious for surrounding himself with people who aren't going to challenge any of his views. But this is the first time that we found something in the paper trail that specifically said that Myers would be that fifth vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I think it's going to become a critical part of her confirmation hearings. She's going to be questioned very closely on this, and it's going to be very hard for her to disavow those statements.
Yeah, and at this point, her candidacy is in real trouble.
Yeah,
I mean,
serious trouble.
She's been meeting with senators trying to get them on her side, but there are plenty of Republican senators on the committee that will have to approve her who are not even interested in talking to her. They don't even think she's a viable candidate.
Yeah, well, she's not. I mean, you know, you or I could be a judge just as easily. We have just as much experience on the ground.
Yeah, and I think we ought to all start sending our resumes to the White House saying, I understand you've got a vacancy open on the Supreme Court. And you
one
know,
at FEMA.
One at FEMA, yeah. You're not necessarily interested in people
Vice
who
President
have,
might need a chief of staff soon.
Yeah, and I understand there's no experience necessary, so why don't you consider me?
Yeah, it's a nice gig.
Yeah, I think it would be. I think it would be a really good, actually, a really good protest move for people to start sending cover letters and resumes to the White House applying for these positions.
You get to wear some nice robes. All right.
If you get the job, yeah.
Moving on, Anwar. Looks like things are percolating there.
Yeah. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee voted 13-9 on Wednesday to include in a budget bill the authorization for drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and not only authorization for drilling, but a requirement that the government lease ANWR and not just the small area where there are oil reserves, but the entire reserve to energy companies to recoup budget costs for cuts that are being made elsewhere in the budget. This is a very scary development. It's because budget bills do not allow filibusters, so it will go up or down on a straight party line vote sometime in the next few weeks, and then it would need to be reconciled with the House. In this case, even though the House is more conservative, there are a number of Republicans in the House who have publicly opposed drilling in ANWR. Something like 23 House Republicans have signed a letter stating that they are opposed to drilling in ANWR, and so. So the efforts will really need to be concentrated there to try and stop drilling. I know it's sort of like Groundhog Day. You keep hearing this warning over and over, but it really is very close this time to coming to pass.
All right.
I think it's also another sign that Bush's approval rating is falling, not only among Democrats but also among members of his own party.
Yeah.
Well, only a couple minutes left. Any events that you wanted to? Nope. Getting blank stares there. Okay. Well, let me bring up again as I keep running across more of these on what I'll call biodefense updates. Turns out there was another little accident this week in the industry that never has accidents.
Uh-huh.
Where this was off of AP and leaking. Yahoo News. Leaking anthrax vial arrives at local lab. Palm Bay police were surprised recently to find that a company is having vials containing anthrax shipped into the city. One of those disease-carrying vials arrived this week with a leak. Researchers at the Midwest Research Institute on Treeland Drive in Palm Bay conducted anthrax research.
Palm Beach, yeah.
Yeah, I believe so. I was thinking originally it was California, but... you're right. Two scientists were exposed to the leaking package, went to Palm Bay Community Hospital immediately. The Institute notified state and federal health authorities, but not the police. Spokesman for the Institute said lab personnel didn't see the need to further notification. Leaking vial arrived by FedEx. FedEx ships dangerous and deadly materials all the time. Those are just some of the highlights out of the article. So when people talk about, you know, that the labs are safe, that whether that's true or not, which is still debatable.
It's not just the labs that are of concern here, obviously.
That's right.
It's the transport
that.
As well.
Yes.
Yeah. Next time you're next
transport
to an idling FedEx
And it's
truck.
Also hospitals. I mean, what if your local hospital who has no facilities and no expertise and no one on staff who knows what to do with an anthrax infection gets an anthrax patient? I mean, what do you do with that? Or get somebody who's been infected with bubonic plague. What do you do with that?
All right. Well, we'll have to answer that next week. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
It comes out every couple of weeks. And in fact, this coming week is going to be our election issue with all of our picks and endorsements and pans for the coming November 8th election. And we'll be talking about that on the radio also in the next couple of weeks. You find it anywhere you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, places like that. Also on the internet, www. www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, donate, anything like that, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.
You know, and I completely forgot that this last 20th of October marked 15 years for Mind Over Matters. That was our 15-year anniversary.
Congratulations.
Hey, happy anniversary.
Anyway, yeah, we're popping the champagne as soon as the mics go off here. So.